The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Diane Swank joins us now. She's chief economist at Mesro Financial, based here in Chicago. Diane, welcome.
It's so great to be here. And welcome you here to my wonderful city.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Indeed. And usually, Diane, either you're in studio with us in New York or you're on the phones. So yeah, this is really fun. So let's start with the news, which in a sense isn't news, but the Senate Banking Committee has confirmed that they're on board with Janet Yellen to be the next Fed chair.
You know, it's good just to have a decision come out of Washington finally rather than indecision. And unfortunately, much of Washington has been indecision rather than decision. So certainly for financial markets, it's nice not to see a major showdown over this after all the hysterics we saw this summer. And I think it's really important that continuity is a reassurance to financial markets, even though they're not quite sure how the Fed is going to sort of manage the next couple months, the next couple meetings.
Well, you know, Dennis Lockhart said to me last week when I interviewed in Montgomery, I asked him about the transition, and many people feel it would be awkward for the current Fed chair, soon to leave, Ben Bernanke, to have the tapering start on his watch. That might be awkward for the next Fed chair. And Dennis Lockhart said, actually, we are looking, data by data, meeting by meeting. It doesn't make a difference. And then Jim Bullard, St. Louis Fed president, told Vonnie and I yesterday that he added to that thought with, you know, Janet's been here through the whole process. It's
exactly.
Not like she's new coming in from the outside. And put the two and two together, it seems to be this market view that there couldn't be a taper until March is misguided.
It is very misguided. I mean, the Fed is going to do what it's going to do. And, you know, I mean, there was that famous moment in the Yellen hearings when Corker said, you know, are you a prisoner sort of the markets? And she said, no, we're not. And they absolutely aren't. They weren't in September. Let's face it. They will do whatever they think they need to do when they need to do it. If they see the opening to December, they'll take it. I don't think the opening's quite there yet because I don't think markets are prepared. And I think they have more groundwork to go. I think Ben Bernanke went a long way this week in laying that groundwork. That said, you could do it on the January meeting of Ben Bernanke's. Bernanke is, you know, the transition of Fed chairs, it's usually been a very difficult process. It was unusually easy when Ben Bernanke took over from Chairman Alan Greenspan. It was very difficult when Alan Greenspan took over after Paul Volcker had been pushed out. So, you know, these are things that this is an easier handoff, but I think ultimately Janet Yellen will have the hardest job of all, and that is managing the other side of her tenure, which is going to be equally as difficult as Ben Bernanke's.
It may not be much of an event, let's say, within the Fed, but it is a market event, though, isn't it, Diane? Don't you think the market will react in some way as soon as there is the handoff?
There is, absolutely. And I think what you've been seeing is the Fed has been trying to sort of, you know, allow this, sort of prepare the market and saying, we're going to sort of bait and switch you. We're going to, you know, go towards forward guidance. We're going to push out the time. We're going to leave that punch bowl out there. And hopefully that'll be enough that tapering, you know, we're worried about its efficacy. And they're trying to wean the market of this idea that tapering's so bad that the Fed is still going to be there. I think it's a little more difficult. It's easier for the Fed to say, and their communication's a little more clear, but they got a long way to clarity on communications, and that's a real issue for the markets.
In fact, another little bit nuanced, but to the Fed, I don't think it's nuanced at all. It seems to me, we asked Jim Bullard about this, asked Dennis Lockhart about it, are you guys trying to tell us that we've got to kind of wean ourselves off of this attachment to tapering, to the bond purchases? Both of them use the same phrase to say it was supposed to be a booster rocket.
Yes.
To get you out into the orbit. But once
right.
you get the orbit, you don't need it. And guys, look, it's like they're trying to say, look over there, forward guidance. We're
right.
going to keep the key rate at zero for years.
Right.
That's where we think the stimulus is and will remain.
Exactly. And even Ben Bernanke said, and the research the Fed published says that's more effective than what they're doing. And so, you know, I mean, you have to also take into account what proportion of the market that the Fed is going to be buying going forward. I mean, you know, at $85 billion a month, you know, $40 billion on MBS and $45 billion on treasuries, people are forgetting the treasury issuance is falling dramatically because the deficit is falling like a rock. It's one of the best kept secrets in Washington. They're going to, after going from 90% of all new mortgage issuances and of all new treasury issuances, they could be buying 120% as we move into next year. That means buying into the secondary market rather than new issuances. The Fed doesn't want it. It's already the 500 gorilla in the room, and it's the idea was to distort markets on the margin, not completely. And they don't want to be in that game of completely distorting markets.
One of the other things that was very interesting about what Jim Bullard said yesterday at the St. Louis Fed was that he really believes the labor market has improved quite a lot. That over the last 3 months, there's been, you know, on average 200,000 of job gains. And he's not too worried about the drop in the participation rate. He says that he's seen data that shows him that it's a cyclical thing to do with demographics and not structural unemployment. Do you agree with him?
You know, I actually have much more concerns about, I think we're starting to see two different labor markets emerge, and you really are seeing the people that have been left behind being more and more marginalized. I worry about the drop in the participation rate among the prime learning and earning age groups of, say, anywhere from 35 to 44 years of age. Not only is that percentage of the population dropping as a percentage of the population, but they're participating less as well. And that's something that I worry about, because you're talking about really compromising skills going forward. And then, of course, we have the record number of almost 32% of young adults up to 34 living with their parents still. That's either because of unemployment or underemployment, and that means critical issues about household formation, home purchases,
home
sales.
This is a big problem, and it's a big deal. But it just seems to me that the Fed is going a little bit out beyond its reach. And I think, but the Fed officials themselves have discussed this, right?
Right.
There's only so much monetary policy can do.
It's
price stability can, you know, prevent or deal with financial crises, but create jobs?
It's really tough. They do create jobs on the margin. Clearly they slowed down the housing market with their mea culpa and how they dealt with tapering in the first place. I mean, let's face it, whatever they want to say the reasons were for the backup in rates and what it meant, the bottom line is the housing market slowed as a result of it. And that's not welcome news for the Fed, because it's critical to going forward. That said, to see how tenuous, how dependent we were on that, you really do worry about the structural versus cyclical problems. And that's the heart of it, right, Kathleen? I mean, we've been saying this is now becoming a structural problem, and the Fed does know it does have some limitations, which gets back to, you know, they'll keep the balance sheet big, but do they want to keep buying these assets if it's not going to be doing really very much and causing a lot of unintended consequences? I mean, one of the things they all say they sort of welcome now is all these sort of bubbles sort of were burst early because of the tapering talk. It was more orderly than it could have been. And now they say, maybe that was planned. And I had to laugh. I said, none of you planned this whatsoever,
Diane,
but you might like it.
What's communication policy going to be like under the new Fed chairman? We haven't heard much from her over the last few months. She's one of the Fed officials that has been quiet.
For understandable
yeah.
reasons. I mean, after the whole issues about who was going to be named the next chairman, she stayed quiet, and deservedly so. But she is head of the Communications Committee, dealing with the two polar opposites, you know, in terms of monetary policy, Charlie Plosser of the Philadelphia Fed, and on the other side of it, Charlie Evans here in Chicago of the Chicago Fed, one looking to even lower the rate at which the Fed targets inflation. Right before Yellen was nominated, he said, or was in her confirmation hearings, Charlie Plosser sent out a text saying, you know, I think that it should be a lower inflation rate. Maybe we should make it 1%. On the other side of it, you've got Charlie Evans saying we should allow some catch up in inflation. So she's been managing the herding these cats for some time, put it that way. And I think what she really truly understands is that the Fed needs more clarity rather than confusion. Does that mean we're going to lose the dissonance? No, not at all. Unfortunately, we're going to see even more dissonance, because there's going to be more people who will likely vote to dissent in terms of monetary policy that become voting members of the FOMC. I do think she is going to try to rein things in a bit, though, and simplify communications. I think there was a sense, you know, Ben Bernanke is an incredible economist, and I can't imagine anyone better qualified for these times. And he's a wonderful communicator, but he's used to teaching Princeton students. And when you're talking to the bond market, you're dealing with people making a yes and no bet, and people who really need things simplified to be able to make those bets.
Well, they need to listen to people like you, Diane, who can distill it all. Ever.
Exactly.
Listen to what you guys
translating
say and then
the
translate it. Yes, exactly. Let's talk a bit about some of the numbers we've seen, because
yes.
just in the last couple of days, and I guess I've got that kind of glass half full aspect of myself, so I'm thinking, ooh, are things really getting a little bit better? You know, the last jobs report, the payrolls came in stronger, the new claims on unemployment benefits, the jobless claims are down to 323,000 again. The retail sales report yesterday came in a little bit stronger than forecast. Is there a little glimmer of hope here?
Well, there's always a glimmer of hope. We have falling gas prices at the pump, and that's one of the biggest, you know, it's like a big tax cut right before Christmas, and so that's the good news. The bad news is, you know, we really are talking about, you know, a very bifurcated economy. The luxury retailer is doing much better. Many retailers are expecting this to be the most promotional season since 2008, which was, of course, not one we'd all want to repeat in any way whatsoever. One of the things I looked at the retail sales is great October numbers, that was good, but revised backwards, the core retail sales were down. And so the consumer actually did worse going into this quarter, and the momentum was less than we thought. We also know that, you know, the malls, the traffic's not been great in November, and the retailers are really scared because of the later Thanksgiving. Let's face it, we all buy our Christmas presents if we're going to buy them between the middle of December and December 25th, and even after that with gift cards and things like that. But I do think you have to really understand what drove the spending. Apparel prices down dramatically, vehicle prices down dramatically, really the deals, the discounts. And that is something that consumers is a reflection of weakness. It's at least getting us spending, but it's not going to be a blowout holiday season. And I think the economy is actually decelerated quite sharply in the fourth quarter because we had all those inventories in the third quarter that we built. Now we got to sell them all. So we're looking at, you know, less than 1.5% growth in the fourth quarter.
What about confidence, Diane? You think consumer confidence is down?
You know, consumer confidence has fallen off quite dramatically. What was surprising was how much confidence stayed down after the shutdown. And a lot of that, I think, was the Affordable Care Act and the mess that put. I mean, anybody who has an IQ and you're watching TV, how can you feel confident about our government at this point in time? And all of that caused uncertainty. The question is, what was the real collateral damage in terms of spending? And that's not clear. I think the consumer is challenged this holiday season, except for the very high end. That's something that's been an ongoing theme. The confidence numbers are beginning. Your own Bloomberg Index is showing they're beginning to come back a bit, and that's the good news right before the holiday season and once we get past some of this noise out of Washington. But what I really worry about is, you know, again, the bifurcation of spending. You hear the lower-end discounters saying they're worried about the end of food stamps and unemployment insurance ending. When that's what's supporting your spending, that's a sign of weakness rather than strength in the economy.
So where are we going? This conference is all about looking ahead to 2014. There are some who think that we'll be stuck in the 2% GDP zip code for a while. Others think maybe we head a little bit towards 3%. But this sense of kind of a pervasive, well, we're not falling, we're growing, but not that rapidly. It's hard to shake that, I think, because you say to yourself, to grow faster, what would have to happen?
You know, I mean, one of the good news is we'll have less fiscal drag. We had over 1.5% of fiscal drag last year, which was mostly on the revenue side, taxes, the expiration of the payroll tax cut, which relative to last year on holiday season is going in the opposite direction of gas prices. So even if we get the worst case scenario in the 2014 sequestration actually is enacted because they can't come up with any kind of a short-term budget, we know what the drag from that is, and it's not as big as last year. So that headwind is abating. State and local governments are doing much better than they were, and they're actually adding to growth now instead of subtracting from growth. But the real linchpin here is what's happening in housing. And that's my biggest, you know, risk on my forecast, although I do have the economy accelerating, not quite getting to the 3% range next year, but accelerating a bit from this year. I do worry about the sustainability of the housing recovery. I worry about the overhang of student loans in more than 40% of households under 35. I worry about falling share of first-time home buyers. And I worry about the lack of construction, because at the end of the day, that's what we really need. And that's one of those things that is a little more tenuous, and that's where my biggest risk in my forecast is.
Just to go back to the sequestration for a moment, what makes you so sure that fiscal drag won't be so bad next year?
We know how much it is. That's the good news.
But isn't it going to be a cumulative effect?
It is a cumulative effect, but it's not as large as that combined with the tax increases that we saw last year as well. That's the good news. The bad news is it's, you know, pain without much progress in terms of government spending cuts, because you're cutting things that are discretionary, you're cutting things that could undermine efficiency, particularly in defense. On the other side of it, you're not getting anywhere you need to go in terms of long-term deficit reduction, and that's dealing with the elephant in the room, which is entitlement spending. You know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, no one's touching that third rail, and we know that the sequestration cuts, they are overwhelmed by these demographic pushes in the next couple of years, 2016, 2017.
So let's take a little bit of a look globally. As I said, we just had Keith Williams, Underwriters Laboratories. He said he is more confident that manufacturing, Chinese economy keeps growing next year. He does business there, testing exporters. People are producing in China, exporting, right? He does see some risk. What do you see for China?
You know, I am worried about China. China is one of the areas that we've been watching very closely because, there's only so many times you can produce. It's a demand, not a demand-driven economy, but an ability of an economy to produce growth on demand. And, they're building infrastructure that's not necessarily being used. It's interesting, I was talking to an auto producer who said, yeah, we're selling a lot of cars there, but they're not driving them anywhere. All they do is park it. And part of that's infrastructure, and part of that's an inability to afford the gasoline to drive the cars around. It's a prestigious thing, and they park their cars, but they don't use their cars. So you do worry about the sustainability. Is Japan going to be able to really do this pivot from being an export-driven economy to being a demand-driven economy? And I think that's a real challenge for China.
Does the U.S.
Did I say Japan? I said China.
Yeah.
Although both of them have a problem with that.
That's very true.
We have a big tax on consumers in Japan coming up in April.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's going to definitely put a dent into Abe's policies. We'll get to Japan in a moment, but just to return to China for a second, does the U.S. need China to grow at a certain rate? Does the U.S. need China to boost domestic consumption in order to give the U.S. an extra little boost?
Actually, they do. I mean, our manufacturing sector does export aggressively. I mean, we import a lot from China, but we also export a lot from China. And everybody, the trade data is so complex now because a lot of U.S. content is in China and then brought back to the U.S. So there is this churn, and also on infrastructure spending, of course, backyard companies like Caterpillar and all these, big construction, they've been sending stuff to China. And when their growth slowed, that hurt us. It's interesting to me when I was at the IMF meeting, one of the questions I said, well, you're all talking about sustainable growth, and China can go to 7% is what the Chinese finance minister was saying, and Christine Lagarde was talking about, world sustainable growth, the pivot from developed economies growing now more steadily and developing economies having some challenges. But I think at the end of the day, we have to get to the issue that we're all interlinked, and the U.S. can't carry the world on its shoulders. Clearly, we're not doing a very good job of it if we are. And that's a real problem, is that, many of these developing economies, we were helping them develop. And if they're not continuing to develop at a fast enough pace, that hurts the rest of the world.
Europe. Mario Draghi introducing the possibility, of a negative deposit rate, and maybe they're going to buy bonds. And,
yeah, welcome to our unconventional world.
And
yeah.
The bank stress tests are starting.
Oh, it's a mess. Europe, it's interesting to me, everyone keeps saying the euro crisis is over. I'm like, this could be, we knew communism couldn't live as an economic form. It took, a long time for it to finally implode. It could take a long time. They're sort of doing this sort of, bubblegum and, rubber bands to the Eurozone, but without fiscal unity, I really cannot see, without Germany backing the bonds of Italy, I cannot see this being a long-term sustainable solution. Does that mean it can't happen for 10 years? We can be 10 years in this, but it is a real issue. Italy is too big to fail. Italy's banks are not in great shape. It's sort of like the dirty little secret is nobody wants to talk about Italy. Now, on the other side of it, how is the adjustment happening now? In Spain, you're seeing 50% wage cuts in manufacturing facilities because they want to keep their jobs. And it's happening without reforms at the government level. It's happening because these people want to have a job.
So let's talk about Europe next time. I think we just got started.
Helps to have an Italian colleague that left Italy for a reason.
There you go. Diane Swong, thank you so very much.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.